Okay, so sorry I changed the title on you guys. Hopefully it'll become clear that it's actually the same talk. It's a bit disconcerting standing here, seeing your talk so high above you. This is the second time I'm trying to give this talk, and it's an area that I haven't worked much in. I'm still learning myself. So if it's not very clear, please feel free to just interrupt me, ask some questions. I realize it's a bit difficult given the distances here, but I think we can manage. All right, so what is this talk about? Well, it's loosely speaking about the difference between this and this. So on the top we have a mixed state, a quantum state that's a mixture of some orthogonal states with some probabilities, pi. Okay? And on the bottom we have a pure state, a coherent superposition of the same set of orthogonal states with amplitude square root of pi. And to some extent, all of the mystery of quantum mechanics is in the difference between these two things. And the danger when you get someone who, like myself, dabbles in foundations coming to give you a talk somewhere like this is that what I'm going to do is spend the talk pontificating about the mystery of how nature somehow takes us from this to this, possibly by decoherence or various other mechanisms. And that's not what this talk is about at all. The talk's really about differences in sort of information theoretic processing between these two different objects. Okay? But how I ended up working on this topic is closely related to things I was dabbling in foundation. So I'm going to just start by giving you the kind of motivation or how I came to this problem that I'm going to talk about. So what I was interested in a few years ago was hidden variable models, and I was interested in whether or not there's a hidden variable model for quantum states where, so in a standard hidden variable model, now I can't see this pointer. In a standard hidden variable model, you have some space of hidden variables, some sort of measure space, something that you can define a probability distribution on, and that's denoted capital lambda here, and associated with the quantum state, psi, you have some probability distribution over those hidden variables. Okay. And the question I was interested in is it possible to have that the space of hidden variables, the elements of that measure space, have a size which is much less than the size of the quantum state? Okay. So what do I mean, or why might you think that that's possible? So let me give you just sort of an intuition for the kind of thing that you might imagine as being as an argument as to why this should be possible. So if you consider having n coins, okay, and I ask you, how many bits of information can I send you if I'm allowed to send you n coins, then I can only send you n bits of information. Okay, you can look at the string of coins and go, oh, it's heads, tails, tails, heads, and so on. Okay. Similarly, if I can only send you n spin half particles, I can only send you n bits of information. Okay, there's a sort of fundamental bound in quantum information that says I can only send you about n bits. So it looks like that, you know, you can't send very much information, but the quantum state description of the n spin half particles is this massive state that has 2 to the n complex parameters. Okay. But in fact, the classical state description of n coins also has 2 to the n parameters. If I had to specify for you what's the probability, the most general probability distribution over n coins, I'd have to specify for you what's the probability of heads, 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 tails, heads, tails, heads, and so on. So it looks like that most of the complication of the quantum state might be sort of in the epistemic description, we would call it, that hopefully I could come up with a hidden variable theory where you know, an exponential number of the parameters are in this probability density, and that the real state, like the real state of the coins here is very simple. It was sort of only n bits. Hopefully the real state of whatever this deeper theory of nature was also sort of contained only on the order of n bits. Okay. So the question was, can you find a hidden variable model like that? And I was playing around with that, and I found that, okay, I couldn't find one, and I was trying to, in fact, prove that such a one couldn't exist. And then I found that my route to a proof wouldn't work, because I managed to just sort of fairly easily show that you can find a hidden variable model that has the following property, that the size of the hidden variables, so let's say, you know, in some sense, the manifold dimension of this measure space, would be on the order of n, okay? So like the coins, it's very small compared to the exponential size of the state. But that instead of obeying the Born rule in this hidden variable model, the probability of seeing an outcome corresponding to some measurement projector pi when the quantum state was psi was given by the Born rule, which would be this, the expectation value of psi pi psi, multiplied by a constant and with some other constant added to it. Okay. So it was a model which didn't reproduce the quantum statistics, but somehow it came close. And confronted with that, I was like, okay, well, maybe there's a way of sort of tweaking this model, of somehow subtracting off the C naught probability here and dividing by the C1 and messing around with this. And so, you know, the hope was that what I could do would be to piece together many copies of this particular hidden variable theory and somehow post-process them in a way that the output probability was actually given by the Born rule, the thing I was really looking for. Okay. And so I started searching around on Google, trying to find out how do you take one probability distribution and kind of output another one, or take many copies of a probability distribution, output a different one. Okay. And in particular, you want to output it exactly here. So I don't want to have infinite numbers of copies here, because you know, they'll essentially defeat the purpose. I'll have an infinitely large hidden variable space. And I don't want to do things approximately, because I'm trying to come up with a model that actually reproduces quantum theory exactly. So I don't want to like estimate the probabilities and output them. So I kind of wanted an exact procedure for taking in many copies of things that output with this sort of probability and get out something like this. And playing around in the literature, the math literature, I found that there's actually a whole area of mathematics and computer science that look at this particular problem. And it's the area dealing with what's called the Bernoulli factory. And the Bernoulli factory is like the simplest version of this problem. So it started in what's called the exact Monte Carlo community. I'm not going to dwell on their origins too much. But the basic idea is this. I have a bunch of coins. And these coins have a bias, so their probability that they show heads is p. Okay, but you don't know what p is. You don't even have a prior on p. All you know is that p is not 0 and it's not 1. Okay, so you have some coins that have some unknown bias p. And you're allowed to take them in and process them and do what you want with them. And at the end of the day, you want to output a single coin that has a probability of heads given by f of p. Okay, where f is going to be some specified function of p. Okay, and in particular, you want to take in a finite expected number of coins. Okay, you don't want to take in an infinite number of coins. And the Bernoulli factory problem is about what functions f of p can you manufacture in this way. So in a little more detail, what goes on inside the machine, as it were, is that you flip these p coins. And based on what you see on a particular string of a certain length, you either accept, which means output heads, reject, which means output tails, or you continue, you just keep flipping. And what we want is that you flip these coins and then you output heads with whatever the specified f of p is. Okay, so let's see if any of you are still awake, given how far away I am. What if f of p was p squared? Okay. How would you flip p coins in such a way that you then can output a new coin such that the probability of heads is p squared? Rob? All right. Okay, so for those of you at the bank, what you do is you flip two coins, and if both show heads, then you output heads. And if in the other three combinations, if either coin shows tails, you output tails. So now you've output heads with probability p squared. Okay. So in that case, you only had to use two coins. You didn't have to sort of flip any more times and so on. If sort of fairly simple generalization of that is if the function was just a polynomial like this. Okay, this is called a Bernstein polynomial in the literature. So it's a polynomial which is sort of a sum of p to the k, 1 minus p to the n minus k, and some integer coefficients which are all less than or equal to binomial n choose k. Then you could just follow a similar procedure, right? Because you would just, for each, so each value of k here kind of refers to the number of heads in a string of length n. So you flip n coins, and then you assign cnk of the binomial n choose k strings that have k heads in them to output heads, and the rest can output tails. Okay, so you can sample a function like this, a Bernstein polynomial, fairly easily. Is that clear? Sort of what's going on? It's just a sort of generalization of the previous one. Okay, what about this though? This is not of that form. So how do I output a coin with f of p given by p squared divided by p squared plus 1 minus p squared? Anyone not know how to do it? Because then I can just ask you. All right, John, how do you do it? Yeah, when I said, does anyone not know how to do it, you should have taken the opportunity to say, you don't know. All right, who does know how to do it? Dan does. Of course, Dan would always know. All right, Dan, tell us how you're doing. Out again. Okay. So this is the conditional probability of heads-heads given that the two coins were the same, either heads-heads or tails-tails. Okay. So in this case, you flip. If both show heads or both show tails, you keep it. And if they're both showing heads, you output heads, obviously. But in this case, when one shows heads and one shows tails, you have to flip another two coins. So it's it takes a finite expected number of coins to output heads, but you know, you're not sort of guaranteed to get an output, let's say, in your first two flips. Okay. How about this one? This is a famous example. What if f of p is just constant, is a half? So this is asking the question, how do you take a coin that you don't even know, you know it's biased, or you, let's say you don't even know what the bias of it is, and output a fair coin? Von Neumann was the first person supposedly to write this down. Anyone? Yeah? Sorry? So, yeah, so the key to doing this one is the fact that heads, tails, and tails, heads, for the first two coins, have the same probability, p times 1 minus p. So regardless of what p is, if you just flip twice, if the two coins show something different, then you can, you know, if it's heads, tails, you can output heads, and if it's tails, heads, you can output tails. So you can produce a fair coin given sort of a coin of unknown bias, as it were. Okay, so far everything we've done looks like sort of rational functions and so on. Okay, so let me just drill down in this von Neumann example just a little bit more. So here is a way of doing slightly better than what I just said. So what I just said was this. It was like flip two coins, and if you see heads, tails, then output heads. If you see tails, heads, output tails. And if you see heads, heads, or tails, tails, start again. Okay, so I can summarize that in the table a little bit like this. Okay, so here's what you can do that's a little bit better. You can say, I'm going to associate these strings with heads and these strings with tails. And now it's consistent with what I said previously. Like if you had heads, tails, so you've got 1, 0 here, then you would output heads. And so you have all the strings that begin with 1, 0 in this set of strings. But we see that previously where we might have just said, okay, I'm going to throw away the two coins and start again, I now have strings like this. So if I get 0, 0 followed by 1, 1, if I was just using this procedure here, I would have to start all over again because I would have gotten heads, heads, and then tails, tails, and then I'd start again. But because I've now assigned that to the outcome heads, I now output heads, and I've got the complementary string over here, so I would output tails. Okay? So I've got a procedure which is a bit more efficient in terms of the number of coins it uses to output still a fair coin with probability 1/2. And it's only in the case where I get, you know, four heads or four tails in a row that I have to kind of keep going. And this procedure can be generalized. The key is to make sure that the strings here sort of match so that you know, you can go and then just stop as soon as you know kind of which set the string must fall into. Okay. Is that clear sort of thing? There's a sort of consistency condition you'd want to follow. But this just gives a slightly better way of outputting a fair coin. Okay. All right, so let's look at something which isn't a rational kind of value. So what if you wanted to output a coin such that the probability of heads is 1 on pi? Okay. So 1 on pi in decimal is about 0.318309, in binary is 0.01010001. Okay. So let's forget for the moment about the pcoin thing. If I just said to you, you know, take MATLAB and choose for me, output for me a bit with probability 1 on pi being 0 or something, how would you do it? Anyone? Some of you program computers here, I know. How do you output with irrational probabilities? You know, Dan?
Well, I don't know the any way of doing it. I mean, I'd probably generate a rational number that's just a pair of the ones of pi close enough, and I would have to generate a digit.
Okay, very good. So Dan can now leave the talk. He knows what's going on. Okay, so here's a way of doing it. So if you take the interval between 0 and 1, here's 1 on pi sitting over here. If you could choose a uniform real number at random between 0 and 1, then what you could do is just, so maybe you call the rand function in MATLAB or something. Then you just call, you output that real number, and if it's less than 1 on pi, you say, oh, now I'm going to output heads, and if it's greater than 1 on pi, you output tails. Okay? So that's how you would do it if you had the ability to generate uniformly at random real numbers. But now we don't really have that ability, but we do have the ability to output a fair coin flip. Okay? So what we do is we just flip coins to generate a number. We interpret the coin flip, so we take our pairs of coins to generate fair coins. Then we take our fair coins and we flip them and interpret the string of heads and tails as a binary number. Okay. So let's say, for example, we flipped and we found that, you know, the very first bit value that we got was a 1. Then we would know that the number that we're generating lies over here. Okay, because the 1 there indicates that this number is greater than 1/2 in binary. And 1 on pi is over here, so we know that whatever number we're going to generate is going to lie up here, and so that we can just output tails immediately. Okay. But if we flipped and the first binary digit we found was a 0, then we would be lying in this interval, and we need to flip again. Okay. If we found we got sort of 0, 0, then we would know that the random number we're generating lies here, and so we can just immediately output heads. But if we flip and we get 0, 1, we need to flip again. And so we just keep on narrowing in. And unless we get extremely unlucky and we flip for infinity, we eventually can tell which side of 1 on pi the random number that we're generating will be. And hopefully it's clear that with just sort of a finite expected number of coin flips, we'll be able to output a coin whose probability of heads is this irrational number, 1 on pi, even though we're flipping sort of just finite fair coins. Is that procedure clear? That you do sort of the simplest example of a very common thing in sampling problems where you try and bound the thing that you want, sort of a difficult thing to output, by a sequence of things that you can kind of easily output samples of. Okay, so that's a bunch of examples of different functions that we can do. Here's the one that seems to be of most interest to the people that work in this community, and I'll be honest and tell you, I'm not sure exactly why this particular example. It's sort of a fiducial example. So what the problem that I guess the people in this Monte Carlo community got interested in was the case that f of p is 2p. Okay. So I've actually only drawn defined f of p between naught and a half. You could define it to be, you know, 1 minus that or something down on the other interval. But just in the interval between p is naught and a half, they're interested in f of p is 2p. Okay. And so there was some discussion in this community and various attempts to try and come up with a way to take in the p coins and output an f of p is 2p coin. And then eventually the hopes of doing so were kind of dashed by a theorem of Keenan-O'Brien in the mid-90s. Okay. So Keenan-O'Brien proved a theorem about the set of all functions f of p that you can hope to generate in the Bernoulli factory by flipping these p coins. And the theorem said that you can manufacture f of p in the Bernoulli factory if and only if f is continuous, okay, which kind of makes sense, and either it's constant, so the things that we've seen already, 1 on pi and a half and so on, or for all values of p, there must exist a k such that min of p, 1 minus p, is greater than or equal to min of f of p to the k, 1 minus f of p to the k. So slightly strange criterion, so let me just try and break it down for you. So let's just see why f of p is 2p does not satisfy this. At the value p equals a half, the min of p and 1 minus p is just a half, and a half won't be greater than or equal to 1 minus f of p to the k for any value of k, because at this point, f of p is 1 at p equals a half. Okay. And what's actually going on is the problem is that in this function sort of comes up and hits the value 1 here. What this criterion amounts to is it says, you can have an f of p between, you know, that sort of comes, does anything you want. It just has to be continuous. It can be jagged. You can do whatever you want. But it mustn't go down to 0 or go up to 1. It has to stay kind of polynomially bounded away. There has to exist some value k such that that whatever your function is, it stays polynomially bounded away from the actual values of 0 and 1. But you give me any other function, so I've only shown you simple functions in the preceding things, but you give me any old function, there's a way of simulating in the Bernoulli factory, but you must satisfy this criterion. Okay? Yeah? No, greater than or equal to, I'm pretty sure. Yes, you're right. Less than or equal to. Yeah. Okay. So what they do in the classical literature is they do a different function. They put a little elbow on the end of it like this. So they pick some epsilon, and they stop the function going all the way up to 1, and they basically pull it down by some value epsilon. They make what they call an elbow function. And then this elbow function does satisfy the conditions of the theorem, and so they can simulate it. And so then they look at the ways of doing that. And the way that, the sort of the primary way of doing it is to do the following. You take the function that you want to simulate. In this case, I've drawn an elbow function, the thing in red here. And you find a series of these Bernstein polynomials, the things that I talked about just before. You find sequences of them that kind of approach this function from both below and from above, okay? And they're polynomials of increasing degree n, okay? And now we know that this sort of polynomial, because we saw it just before, it's easy to accept and reject according to this particular polynomial, right? So, roughly speaking then, what you do is you just sort of, you for a given value of n, you sort of sample n coins, and then the strings that, for this guy, that correspond to heads, you accept, and the strings that this, for this blue polynomial that correspond to tails, you reject, or you output tails, and then there's some strings in between that just say keep going, which basically means come down to the next polynomial. So this is just a more sophisticated version of what we were doing with the 1 on pi example. That's why I sort of introduced that example. You kind of have some things that it is easy to sample with, and you kind of approach in onto the thing that's difficult. Okay. So that's the sort of classical way of doing it. Seems like a smart way of doing it. The problem is that it just doesn't work very well, primarily due to the fact that these Bernstein polynomials are concave. And so what you find is that just to do a fairly simple f of p, so this is an f of p with a big elbow in epsilon 0.2. It takes 2 to the 16 coins just to output a single f of p coin, okay? Which means those polynomials, you're looking at polynomials of degree going up to, 2 to the 16. Seems quite ridiculous. It's a difficult procedure. Like, what I've glossed over here is the fact that you've got two different polynomials here. And in the same way as with the von Neumann coin, where you've got to keep the strings consistent so that, every string of length n, the set of strings of length n to say that you would output tails have to be consistent with the strings of length n minus 1 and so on. It's a completely messy thing, and there's a lot of sort of details in it, but they do it, and this is sort of what they find. It takes 2 to the 16 coins in the worst case, so sort of for the worst values of p in that interval. Okay, so I don't know. It's an interesting problem, and there are other ideas. People are now investigating sort of what are called super martingale ideas in the classical literature, I'm trying to understand. So there's people still working on different ways of doing this. But when I started reading about this literature, then, of course, the next thing for a quantum person to do is to say, okay, well, what happens if I take the thing and make it quantum? Okay. So for that, I'm going to introduce what I'm going to call a quantum coin. Okay. And now we're going to go to the very simplest version of the thing I was talking about right at the beginning, which is the classical coin for the Bernoulli factory is just, I'm going to think of it as just a single qubit, which is 0 with probability p and 1 with probability 1 minus p. And the coin, the quantum version of the coin, is just going to be square root of p0 plus square root of 1 minus p1 for some p that we don't know what it is. Okay, so this sort of thing has been called, I think Derrida Haranov probably coined the term, a Q sample. When you go from a mixed state, some mixture of some objects with some probability pi, to kind of the coherent quantum version of the same objects, she called that a Q sample. Okay. And in fact, Q sampling is a very interesting topic in its own right. And I'm going to now spend quite a bit of time going through for you what we know about Q sampling and why it's interesting. And sort of defining the rules of the game a little bit. So here's a bunch of objects. This is my current group of grad students. Okay. And classically, you might say, I want to sample some member of some object from that group. according to some probability distribution. So I have a bunch of objects, omega I, and I want to sample them with some probabilities, pi. And so because we're doing computation and so on, you just associate different bit strings with the different objects. Okay. And so the question of Q sampling is, you know, if, for example, I wanted to sample Hugo, David, and Mike with probabilities a half, a sixth, and a third, then I'm asking, you know, classically, I know I could do that. I would just generate some random numbers and pick one of them according to those probabilities. But now I'm asking a kind of quantum question, which is, can I generate this quantum state, square root of a half, this bit string, square root of a sixth, this one, and so on. And then it's not so obvious whether you can or cannot easily do that. Okay, so to give a very sort of important example of that, I'm going to start by just talking about permutations. So consider permutations of the integers 1 through n. Okay, so here's, you know, for n equals 3, I've got 6 different permutations, 1, 2, 3, 1, 3, 2, 2, 1, 3, and so on. Okay. And imagine I ask you to choose a permutation at random. Okay. So with probability 1 on n factorial, I want you to output one permutation, sigma I. Okay. In fact, this is something that if you're not experienced in computer programming, you can make a mistake. I know that because I made that mistake once and screwed up some research when I was an undergrad, actually. So choosing permutations at random can be done, but it's not... you have to be careful to show that you're really doing it uniformly at random. Okay. You know, there's different procedures involving, you know, choosing random transpositions to apply to a string and so on. But one way of doing it is just to choose a number from 1 to n factorial uniformly. And then there are functions you can compute which for a particular I will tell you which permutation sigma I you should output. Okay, so that's a very trivial way of doing this. Okay. So classically, it's easy to choose a permutation at random. But now, if we want to say, what is the quantum version of this procedure, there's sort of two possibilities. The most simple quantum procedure would be the following. Would be like, well, produce a uniform superposition of all of the indices from 1 to n factorial in one register. And then whatever was the classical function which output permutation sigma I, you know, given the value I, do that. And here you would have a quantum state which would seem to be a coherent quantum version of this trivial classical procedure. But another thing you might want to do is you might say, well, I don't want this index I. I really just want a coherent superposition of the permutations themselves. Okay. So I don't want this kind of entanglement. And in fact, that is what we want for Q sampling. We want this sort of thing, and we don't want this sort of thing. And whenever we get this sort of thing, it actually goes and messes things up. So for that reason, I'm going to call this a poo sample. Okay. Okay. So why might that be useful? So here's a famous example. Here are two graphs. Okay, and there's a famous problem in computer science, which is to decide whether or not two graphs are isomorphic. Are they the same or not? Okay. So these two graphs, you can tell by eye, but if you were trying to automate this procedure, each graph has an adjacency matrix here, a symmetric matrix, and I can encode the graph by just the bit string in the top, in the upper right half of the matrix, the triangle of the matrix. So here, 1, 0, 1 is all the information I need to specify that this is the adjacency matrix of this graph. And similarly, the bit string 1, 1, 0 is all I need to specify that the adjacency matrix of this graph. Okay. And now deciding whether two graphs are really isomorphic or not amounts to running through all permutations of the labelings of the graph and seeing whether the adjacency matrices are ever the same. If they're ever the same, then the graphs are isomorphic. And if they're never the same, then they're not isomorphic. Okay. So here I could switch, like here I flipped the labeling on these two vertices, and now I get a different graph, and I get, in this case, the same bit string, 101. Here I get a different bit string. And then I can apply a different permutation. So I'm just labeling, you know, I'm applying different permutations, sigma naught, sigma 1, sigma 2 to these graphs. So here I've got 110. and here I got 0, 1, 1. But at this point, we see, this is the same as this. 1, 1, 0 is the same as 1, 1, 0. So these two graphs are isomorphic to each other. Okay. Now, the problem for the graph isomorphism problem, the reason it's difficult is that if you have, you know, more vertices and more edges, then suddenly you're having to run through n factorial different permutations trying to decide if the two graphs are the same. Here's an example that's not so easy to spot by eye. Here's an example that really is difficult to spot by eye. This is my favorite pair of graphs because many years ago when I worked on graph isomorphism, this was a pair of graphs that I managed to show that, that hardcore boson-Hubbard models could distinguish these two graphs and show that they weren't isomorphic. So it was kind of a fun thing to do. Anyway, that's a bit of an aside. So yeah, graph isomorphism is difficult. But here's the thing. We've seen that classically you can sample a permutation easily at random. So it's also classically easy to sample a permutation of the graph uniformly at random. You just pick a permutation and then apply that to the adjacency matrix and bang, you output sigma I of g. Okay? So you can take that procedure and easily make the Poo sample of that procedure. You can take make sum over I, sigma I of g, okay, of whatever the adjacency matrix of the graph is. So it's easy to create that quantum state. But it's difficult to create the quantum state which is a genuine Q sample of the permutations of the graph. Okay? If you could create this, in fact, you would be able to solve the graph isomorphism problem and you'd be a famous person. Okay? And the trick is just very simple, that if you can create this superposition and these two graphs are isomorphic, then the overlap of the graphs is one if the graphs really are the same, because one of these permutations here one of the terms in the superposition here will match one term in each, one term in this superposition there. But that if the graphs are not isomorphic, then the two states will be orthogonal. And so all you're trying to do is tell, are these two states orthogonal or the same? And for that, there's a famous simple trick called the swap test that will do it for you. So the swap test just says, take an ancilla in the state plus, apply a controlled swap between the two states that you're trying to compare to tell whether they're the same or not. So controlled on this being a zero, apply the swap, do another Hadamard, do a measurement, and a line or so of algebra will tell you that the probability of this measurement being zero or one is given by a half, one plus or minus the overlap of the two states. Okay? So if the overlap is one, then you have no probability of ever getting the one state, and so you can just easily boost this into telling whether or not the two graphs are isomorphic. So if you could Q-sample, so we've got a distribution that's easy to sample classically. You can output the combinatorial objects classically with a certain distribution, but somehow you can't create the quantum superposition easily classically. And the reason why I don't like these guys, the Poo samples, is that they always orthogonal. Even if the two graphs were isomorphic, these two guys would be orthogonal because these indices here, index I and index j, kind of give you a delta function, which means you lose that fact that the graphs, that the two states would be parallel if the graphs were isomorphic. Okay. So that's one example of the power of Q sampling. Okay. So given that we think we can't Q-sample graphs, what do we think that we can Q-sample? So there's a large class of problems or a large class of things that we can Q-sample. And remember, the whole game with Q-sampling is not to do something that the classical algorithm can't do. We sort of just want to take a classical algorithm that does exist and make it coherent. Okay? So I'm going to use a notation where I let P00 0, 0, and so on be the probability of all the different n-bit strings. So, you know, in some of the problems, we're only interested in a subset of those strings. You know, with some, this could be our combinatorial object omega 1, and this with probability p1, and so on. And that what we know about Q sampling can basically be summarized by this little condition here, that if there exists an efficient classical algorithm to evaluate the conditional probabilities, the probability that the kth bit is zero given values for bits 1 through k minus 1, okay, in our strings here, then this probability distribution can be Q-sampled. Okay? This is essentially what we know about Q-sampling. So you might say, well, are there any interesting problems that have that property? And in fact, in the mid-90s, there was a large number of very exciting results proven in computer science of how to solve a bunch of what had been considered difficult problems using Monte Carlo type methods. So basically, the mathematicians and computer scientists took procedures that physicists had been using, and physicists had been doing kind of hit and hope Monte Carlo. Very often you do Monte Carlo and you just run it and you hope that all the initial correlations have died and you hope that you're getting a genuine sample of whatever you're doing. And they managed to prove that a whole bunch of these different Monte Carlo algorithms for some really interesting problems actually worked and actually converged and mixed and so on. And the problems that they proved them for were quite different things. One related to physics was, of course, the ferromagnetic easing model, but how to compute permanence of non-negative matrices or volumes of convex bodies in high dimensions or integration of log concave functions and so on. And Lovegrover sort of realized when this was happening that the self-reducible nature of these problems meant that you could Q-sample them. And we wrote a little note here on how you do that. And the idea is very simple. So I'm going to give you the n equals 2 example. So what you want to do is you want to output a quantum state that looks like this, okay, square root of p naught, naught, and so on. But you can only compute the kind of conditional probability of each bit having a particular value. So the probability that the first bit has value 0 is p00 plus p01. Probability that it has value 1 is p10 plus p11. It's easy to start the first qubit off in a state like this. You just, you know, take a qubit and rotate it. And then what you do is you use those kind of sophisticated classical algorithm, whatever it is, and then, you know, they're highly non-trivial algorithms, to compute into an ancillary register the conditional probability. So this is the probability that the second bit is 0 given that the first bit is 0. And this is conditional probability of the second bit is 1 given that the first bit is 1. And then you take some ancilla and you rotate it. There should be a 0 here. You rotate the ancilla controlled on the value in this register. And then you by angles that are sort of the square roots of the values in this register. So these sorts of angles. And then you disentangle, you do the uncomputation. And now when you go and put these values in, you see that in a sort of standard Monte Carlo trick, you get square roots and denominators canceling square roots in the numerator, and you get left with the thing that we wanted, which was this state here. Okay. So it's a very simple idea, and all it does is leverage these very powerful classical algorithms for a classically sampling. And that's pretty much everything we know in quantum computation about what we can Q-sample. This idea is most modern quantum algorithms, the quantum algorithms for simulating field theories or solving linear equations or doing quantum chemistry, they use this as kind of a starting point, a way of setting up initial states in the algorithm. There's one other set of results that, due to Dorit, that use a quite different way of producing Q samples, which is to use adiabatic quantum computation. And as far as I can tell, this is the only set of results that might work for non-self-reducible problems. So non-problems that fit into that class of sort of, you can always compute the conditional value for a bit given other bits, the probability of it. But in fact, they didn't apply it. I mean, they say in the paper, we think it should work for some non-self-reducible problems, but they didn't actually find any particular applications for it. It seems to me that there's still a lot that we don't know about this problem and that we should know. Okay. All right, so Let me go back to the coin. So now that diversion into Q sampling has hopefully convinced you that I'm not just playing, you know, a silly quantum game when I say I want to go from a procedure that outputs with probability p heads and 1 minus p tails to a procedure that produces the quantum coherent version of that, okay, even if I don't know what p is. Okay. So given that I've now, let's say, partially justified considering coins as an interesting object of study, let's look at the sort of thing that they can do. Okay. So remember this theorem which tells us about what you can or cannot manufacture in the classical Bernoulli factory. Let's look at this particular f of p. Okay. So here's an f of p, which is square root of p plus square root of 1 minus p all squared over 2. So at p equals 0, it starts at a half. At p equals 1, it goes back to a half. It goes up and it touches the value 1 here and it comes back down. Okay. So this f of p is something that the Keane-O'Brien theorem tells me that there is no classical way of sampling this f of p with any finite number of coins. Okay. You would need it, you know, there's just no finite procedure that will output a coin with this particular f of p, this funny looking f of p, okay? Because the function hits 1 here at p equals a half, okay? All right, so, but if I take a quantum coin, which is root p0 plus root 1 minus p1, and I just apply a Hadamard gate to it, then the probability of getting 0 when I now make a measurement in the computational basis is exactly this f of p. Okay. So it tells us that the quantum coin, even a single quantum coin, is infinitely more powerful in some sense than the classical coins. It can do something that's impossible for the classical coins. So the reason why I really like this observation is that for most of the things in quantum information where we can say, here is something that provably you cannot do in a classical information processing, most of those things are communication tasks, key distribution and things like that. Okay? But this is not a communication task. And or they are computational tasks that are defined with respect to an oracle, which is sort of a messy computer science type of thing. So here's just a very simple, the most basic thing that you can hope to sort of say is, you know, even for a single qubit, it's possible to differentiate very strongly what you can do classically versus what you can do quantumly. Okay. So in fact, there's a lot more fun that you can have once you sort of start thinking about this, and we're working hard at that. Just trying to work out different things that we can do. We're trying to prove now, in fact, I thought we had a proof, but I certainly thought I'd have it by the time I was giving this talk, and I think I know sort of what it is, but I want kind of the quantum version of the Keane-O'Brien theorem. So what functions can coins sample? And it seems that you can do any function that hits 0 or 1 kind of a finite number of times, but proving that's a little bit more difficult than what I expected. But even just for doing the functions that they're interested in classically, we want to work out some things about, you know, how many coins can we save. So we can certainly do things more efficiently this way. There's questions like, are doing, you know, entangled measurements on coins and so on, is that more powerful than doing individual processing of the coins? But there's also questions that I think relate to things like the subroutine problem in quantum computing, which is, you know, how do I create kind of quantum samples of like square root of f of p0 plus root 1 minus f of p1 when I have procedures that don't terminate, that only have finite expected terminations? This sort of thing is actually extremely difficult. Okay. So there's a bunch of different things that we're looking at. So I was hoping to have a proof of this quantum Keane-O'Brien theorem, but I don't. And I've been yelling at my poor student, Howard, who's been working on it, but that hasn't helped. So I can't give it to you. I'm fairly sure I know what it is. Okay. So what the last thing I want to do is just go on about sort of one more kind of observation about Q sampling, something which I'm not sure if this is trivial or not. In fact, I'm almost putting it up because I'm hoping that someone here can point out to me, oh no, there's a trivial way of achieving the same thing. So the last thing, the thing that I'm going to sort of end on, if I have enough time, is the following observation. Okay. So why does a computation take time? Well, in the three models of quantum computing that we have, the circuit model, adiabatic model, and the cluster state model, it's really quite different. In the circuit model, gates don't commute with each other, and they take time because Hamiltonians have certain spectral gaps, and you can't just run them infinitely fast. The adiabatic computation, it sort of depends on the lowest energy gap, how fast you can run it. Cluster state computing seems very different. There it depends on, how fast does the wave function collapse and how fast can you feed forward your data and so on. Okay. But somehow all of these models of computation, you squash out the answer to the computation and it takes some time, right? And they're all sort of consistent with how much time it takes. Okay. So I'm just going to throw up a sort of an observation about the cluster state model that I'm not sure if it's really deep or not. So in the cluster state model, you make measurements on the qubits and you get outcomes that you can label 0 or 1 that are just, they're just binary measurements in the equatorial plane of the Bloch sphere. And so you might have n qubits that you make the measurements on and then some output n plus 1th qubit that you want to know, is it 0 or is it 1? Okay. So in the big picture, all that you've done is you've got some classical bit string of measurement records here, and then and then you know, based on these records, that you have the output or something related to the output that you want. So consider a case where I Q-sample all the measurement records that output the state omega, the output to the computation that I want, and that don't output sort of what happens in cluster state computations, that you can also output omega, but with, say, a Pauli X or a Pauli Z or something. So let me take the subset that output really what I want. So here's a Q sample of those bit strings. It has order 2 to the n terms. And then once you have this, it's possible to apply a unitary matrix that creates a superposition of the actual states that correspond to the projectors that you would have done for each element of this measurement record. Okay. So this state M here is like a coherent superposition of projectors. It's a weird kind of object. Okay. It's a coherent superposition of all sort of roughly 2 to the n measurements you could have made. And now, so imagine I take a procedure that creates this guy M. So M here is a state that kind of encodes a measurement in it somehow. And then I produce in some different qubits, I produce the cluster state on which this measurement would supposedly happen. Now at this point, I don't have the answer here on this output qubit. And I don't have the answer anywhere on any of these qubits. Okay. But if I go do the swap test now between M and C, the swap test, like we saw before, essentially kind of pushes the state M as an overlap onto the state C and instantaneously gives me the output to the computation on this n plus 1th qubit here. I say instantaneously because the controlled swap gates all commute with each other. So it's a slightly dodgy observation, possibly, but it seems to me that like you can sort of do it takes time to prepare these states here, but that you can do the measurement instantly almost. There's no fundamental reason in quantum mechanics why these gates need to take any time at all. They can all be done simultaneously. So I don't know. This is my sort of something I've sat and thought about for a while. I don't really know if maybe there's just, if it's a silly observation that there's some other way of doing it, but I kind of like it, and it seems another way of showing the power of sort of Q-sampling, as it were. Okay, so my time's up. I was going to write some conclusions, as you could see, and then I was like, I don't know really what the conclusions are. But before I prepare a talk, I always just start with a slide of what am I going to talk about. So this is what I talked about. I started with this ontological model through to the classical Bernoulli factory. Then, you know, y square root of p, q sampling, graph isomorphism, back to kind of a quantum Bernoulli factory, and then this last kind of slightly crazy thing on instantaneous computation with q sampling. So I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
So we like to give students the first chance to ask questions. Are there any students with questions?
Okay, all the way up there.
Somebody wants you to get some exercise.
So would you mind repeating why when you do that sampling on the function you show at a very at the end of this the presentation, why do you require the infinite amount of time, infinite time to sample it classically, and how do you do that quantumly?
So quantumly, you can do it because you just can apply a Hadamard transformation to the coin, and that just happens to be the function that came out. I mean, that's why I chose that function. Classically, I think the way to think of it is you don't know what P is, right? You don't even have a prior on P. This game is not played with you sort of having any knowledge of P at all. So now if the function happens to go to 1 at some particular value, like there at P equals 1/2, What sort of sets of bit strings are you going to be able to ever output with certainty heads? Because the function going to 1 says you must output heads with certainty, right? So how to think of it? It's like you can't do acceptance rejection sampling because you can't get into the function from above. You can only kind of get into it from below. And so just classically, I mean, that's sort of the essence of that Keane-O'Brien theorem. I mean, that's the intuition, I guess, as to why you can't do it, that you just can't squish in some sort of Bernstein polynomial above the function at that point. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously not a trivial result.
Any other students with questions?
So you make the claim that this Q coin is in some sense more powerful than a classical coin because it can do this, it can do what you described as exact Monte Carlo sampling when you can't do it with classical coins. So I'm not sure what the word exact means in exact Monte Carlo sampling, so maybe you could give me some kind of some way of understanding in what sense this is more powerful if I want to, say, do a Monte Carlo sampling problem.
Yeah, okay, I said it comes from that community. It's sort of the most basic version of it. So exact Monte Carlo, maybe it's good to, let's think like physicists. So think about the ferromagnetic easing model sampling. Okay, you start, the way a physicist normally does it is you start with some configuration and then you flip some spins, accepting and rejecting, and then you run for a certain period of time and you hope that you know, you've mixed the Markov chain in some sense well enough that you're getting a representative sample. Okay. So in fact, there's another way of doing so there you always get out some sample with, you know, that's you hope is close to the in Kolmogorov distance from the exact Gibbs distribution. There's actually a way of sampling the ferromagnetic easing model such that you get exactly the Gibbs distribution. Okay, it's not, I don't know why physicists don't use it so much. Maybe it's slightly less efficient. So it's called the Prop-Wilson algorithm, and the procedure is called coupling from the past. And so you start kind of in negative time, and you run through kind of every possible initial configuration through to the present, and it's a sort of weird algorithm. And then if they've all coalesced to the same distribution, then you output that, and if they haven't, you go further back in time, you run forward using the same random numbers. I mean, it's sort of easy to describe, I'm not doing a good job of it, how the algorithm runs, but why it gives exact samples is kind of subtle. But, you know, it's part of, there is a way of doing some Monte Carlo such that you get the exact distribution. You don't just get these approximate distributions. Yeah. But whether that one can be made quantum, I don't know. So that's an open question. Like whether the Prop-Wilson algorithm can be made to give proper Q samples that are exactly Gibbs, I don't know.
Yeah. Are there student questions? Okay, let's throw the floor open to questions from non-students, and of course, students can continue to ask questions.
Isn't there another microphone?
So I'm wondering if you've thought at all about this, the classical Bernoulli machine, as one of a set of results that have the flavor of solving the problem of priors in Bayesian probability theory. So another such result would be the Diffinetti theorem. And if you have two agents who disagree on the bias of a coin, but they agree that it's an exchangeable sequence, then they'll both act as if they have some distribution over biases, and if they look at enough coins, then eventually those distributions will converge, and there'll be a sense in which they sort of have an objective probability distribution now, so it doesn't matter what the prior was. And so this seems very similar. The Bernoulli machine, you know, you have a sort of assumption of exchangeability, these are independent coin flips, and you know, it doesn't matter if you think of that original P as, you know, an agent's prior about the coin flip, then it doesn't matter what their prior was. At the end, they're going to assign the same distribution for the output.
But they still won't know what it, I mean, the cute thing about it is that they assign it as F of P. They output F of P, but they still don't know what P is.
Well, in the case of F of P equal to a half, the von Neumann one.
In the case of F of P equals a half.
Then it doesn't matter what P is.
Right. But then if, you know, if it's P squared or something.
Sure.
It's like just as.
I guess as a solution to the problem of priors, I would really need F of P to be independent of P.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was
but
just curious.
The thing is, yeah, because, you know, and the fact that you can't have P as 0 or 1, obviously, is sort of similar to the Bayesian thing, where, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't thought about it like that.
Any other? Giving me a workout today.
Isn't it true that in some sense you can't do any of these classical things because you, to do them really right, you need a perfect random number generator, which as far as we know, we don't know how to do classically.
Right.
So even to do those, you need quantum systems.
Yeah. There's almost a chicken and egg problem there. I guess they could say, well, I'll go buy from ID Quantique, a quantum random number generator, use that to output their classical samples. But, yeah.
I had a real question. Sounds like this is.
Go ahead, sorry.
You referred a couple of times to the graph isomorphism. I just wanted to make sure I understood the status. You're saying it's no progress has been made, but it's not known that it's impossible. Is that right? I mean,
There could exist a quantum algorithm. The ways that people are trying to do it are not to produce the Q samples that I was talking about. I mean, they're trying more sophisticated methods, and you know, some progress has been made, but at the moment it's still up in the air. But I think, you know, we're reasonably skeptical that there would be such a quantum algorithm.
So I just had a comment on the previous comment, which was that another reason why it's sort of impractical to perfectly sample is that you have to be willing to wait an infinite amount of time. If you're only willing to wait, you know, 100 days or 1,000 days or whatever it is, then if you say beforehand, I'm going to stop after 1,000 days, then it's not a perfect sample, even if you use these.
So that Prop-Wilson algorithm gets around that, and variations thereof get around that, because by this coupling from the past. So they don't asymptotically go to the exact algorithm. They give you the exact distribution in finite expected time. It's a subtle thing. But the
that's finite expected time, sorry? As opposed to, I mean, if you say, like, I'm definitely stopping after 1,000
right.
days.
So that is a problem, but there are even ways of doing it, like, because as you say, like, if someone gets impatient and they interrupt, they add a bias to the thing. There's even something called Fell's algorithm or something, which allows you to interrupt the Prop-Wilson algorithm and do it. So, you know, I'm far from an expert on that stuff, but okay. Roughly speaking, there are some things like that. But I think that it is sort of interesting. So if you think about that 1 on pi example, let's say I wanted you, I said, produce for me a quantum state whose amplitude is root 1 on pi 0 plus, you know, whatever, square root of 1 minus 1 on pi 1. Now, how would you take that coin flipping procedure for classically producing a 1 on pi sample and make it quantum? You can't do it because of what we call the subroutine problem, essentially, that you know, in quantum algorithms, you need your subroutines to kind of terminate after a known amount of time. And, like, if we did that algorithm now, you and I, and you saw me just flip the coin once behind here, you wouldn't assign 1 on pi. The only reason you assign 1 on pi is that, you know, you have to believe that that's the only information you have, that I did it somewhere behind there and I could have taken however long to do it, right? So as soon as you incorporated the extra information you had, you actually wouldn't assign 1 on pi.
Any other questions?
So when you look at that flow chart there, you see it's not a closed path. Do you have any idea? I mean, everything started from this question about the ontological model and so on.
Right, so
it
started off there.
Is it planning to feed back there at all?
I mean, the upshot was, as you might expect, that you can do it. The problem is just that the number of copies that you would need of that underlying ontological model was so large that, in fact, it was that the classical Bernoulli factory is so bad that it would be far worse than the quantum state in terms of, you know, the redundancy or let's say, the hidden variable.
So you could efficiently simulate the quantum system with a quantum system.
Yeah. Okay, then let's thank Terry again.
Thank you.